Hello and welcome to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3, Sydney's local and independent current affairs. I'm Max Tillman. Today on Razor's Edge...
Unfortunately, those people who live on or work on the Big Hill in Canberra aren't pulling their share of the load.
Food Bank Australia has made headlines this week after the Morrison government backflipped on its decision to slash the food relief program by 50%. I looked into how many people in Sydney rely on Food Bank for their daily source of food and what a cut in funding would mean for the city. Also coming up on Razor's Edge...
In the era now of all these smart devices, you know, we're passively collecting so much digital information that we don't even know about it. In fact, most people probably don't even realise what their smartphone is actually recording about them.
Your smartphone knows more about you than you realise. So, how would you feel if your phone could be used to diagnose an illness before you even showed symptoms? All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first... Today marks the one-year anniversary of the marriage equality yes vote in Australia.
Third reading, a bill for an act to amend the law relating to the definition of marriage and protect religious freedoms and for related purposes.
That's it.
Celebrations are taking place all across Sydney and the country in celebration of what was a landmark achievement for the LGBTQI community. Peter Duval, a founding member of the Australian LGBTQI movement, fought for the right to marry his partner, Bon Boone, for over 50 years. But sadly, Bon died before the yes vote was won in Parliament. Morgan Burley spoke to Peter Duval about what it was like living with Bon in Sydney during the 60s and how bittersweet the yes vote was for him.
I got together with my partner, Peter Bonsall Boone, in 1966. And we remained a couple until last year, so we were together for 51 years. So, very early period of our relationship, there was a lot of dislike for our community in the general community. There was a lot of fear. People were worried about coming out. You could lose your job very easily if you came or said a few words and if you were disliked. The other thing, of course, which was a really big issue for male homosexuals, there was a statute on the law books which could potentially give us 14 years in prison for having consensual sex in private. So my partner and I lived under those dreadful conditions and fears that the police might bust in, arrest us, drag us to the court, for something which was expressing love to one another and which was consensual.
There was such a risk back in those days that you could lose your job or end up in jail. So why did you speak out?
We used to say to each other, surely our lives could be better, but we would never to the stage of perhaps organising a community group or an action group or things like that. It wasn't until 1970 when the founders of the very first national homosexual rights movement in Australia in 1970, they founded an organisation called CAMP, C-A-M-P, which stood for Campaign Against Moral Persecution. Now, having said to each other, we would love to join something, there was the opportunity for us to do so.
It certainly was a very bittersweet moment for you when the legislation did pass through Parliament. What were your initial thoughts?
It probably was the loneliest day in my life and certainly the most bittersweet day in my almost 50 years of activism. I was at home all by myself. No one came to visit. No one was here to hold my hand because, you know, I already knew that it would be difficult because of my partner passing away about 5 months before the actual legislation passed in federal parliament. We had one attempt, and I think that was in about April of last year, on Good Friday. There was a wonderful article in our local newspaper here, the Sydney Morning Herald, which said, desperate couple, you know, something like that. So in our desperate attempt, we forwarded that article with a very short note saying, Mr. Turnbull, you can make this happen, but please do it quickly. And we posted that to his electoral office. We faxed it, we emailed it, and I had wonderful Senator Janet Rice from the Greens in Victoria. She actually hand-delivered that note to the Prime Minister's office in Parliament. And we never, ever had a response. That probably was the hardest thing to deal with.
Do you find that you hold anger that it wasn't legalised sooner?
Oh, yes, most certainly, yes. I didn't realise that I still had quite a bit of anger and grief, which I've been hiding, I think, because it was like a catalyst for me to take me back to that day, not only that day, but the period that we campaigned so hard and our voices in Parliament were just not heard.
If Bun was still here today, what do you think would be his reaction to the news?
He would have been elated like myself because we already had, on our 50th anniversary, we had a big party and we have a couple of honorary grandchildren, and I had secretly organized that at the celebration I would present him with wedding rings, and then our honorary grandson put them on our fingers. Well, I couldn't believe the smile on Bond's face on that day, so I can only imagine that on the 7th of December last year, when the Marriage Act actually changed, that his smile would have been that big. It would have been just tremendous.
Peter Duvall, a founding member of the Australian LGBTQI movement, ending that report by Morgan Burley.
Enjoy what you're hearing? Help us to keep it coming. 2SER is supporter funded. We rely on your generosity to continue producing the independent stories, ideas and music you love. You can support us at any time by heading online to 2ser.com/support. Thanks for being part of the 2SER community.
I'm Max Tillman and you're listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. This week, the Morrison government dramatically backflipped on its reduction of Food Bank Australia's funding by 50%. The decision comes less than 24 hours after the announcement, with the government going as far as adding an additional $1.4 million over the next 4.5 years. I spoke to Gerry Anderson, the CEO of Food Bank New South Wales and ACT, to ask if the government takes food relief seriously as Sydney's population and the cost of living continues to rise.
Look, the reality, I think the decision was made without a lot of knowledge from the federal department and the federal minister. We've issued an invitation to Paul Fletcher on Monday to come and visit and see the magnitude of what we do. They're huge numbers. Last year, that equated to 20 million meals just in New South Wales and ACT alone.
How is the funding from a federal level distributed amongst the states and territories?
The federal government provides funds, albeit small amounts of money, because 3 years ago we were getting $1.5 million, and then they reduced that to $750,000, and then this latest cut, which has now been sensibly reversed, another $430,000.
So a huge amount of the process is essentially subsidised.
Yeah, the manufacturing industry are our partners. I mean, even the Australian milk industry, even though they've gone through tough times, all the major players in the milk industry support what we're doing, and we give them some of those federal government funds to subsidise what they're doing.
How much funding does the Sydney metropolitan area receive per year, roughly?
20% of that total funding, because we're a third of the population of Australia, so all of the federal government funded through Food Bank Australia Food, we get a third of that. That's a significant amount. 4 million people in 2018, and a third of those live in New South Wales and the ACT.
And what are some of the reasons that you think these numbers are increasing, particularly in New South Wales?
High energy costs, high costs of fuel, high rent. Just the general costs of living are so high that food has become a discretionary spend.
1 in 6 Australians report having experienced food insecurity at least once in the last 12 months, and over a quarter of these people consider it a regular occurrence. What sort of circumstances are allowing this cycle to perpetuate itself.
And the last survey showed 51% of those people who we surveyed through the welfare agencies that we supply food to are the working poor.
And what are some of the major demographics that you often see with your program? Are they families, single men, single mothers?
No, look, they tend to be the working poor families, and then the single parent families, then the unemployed.
$750 million a year to be divided amongst the states and territories doesn't seem like a particularly high figure at all when considering over 43,000 people seeking food relief each month are unable to be assisted by charities and community groups.
It's miserable. Unfortunately, those people who live on or work on the big hill in Canberra aren't pulling their share of the load, and it's about time they did.
And do you think that, because Morrison made it quite clear that the emphasis was going to be on drought-affected areas, so do you think at all that maybe metropolitan areas may see a lack of funding in turn because of the Morrison government's incentive on affecting drought-affected areas?
From a food bank perspective at the moment, the Morrison government haven't given a cent to food bank in Queensland and New South Wales to help with drought. And, you know, in the year we've just completed, that was about 70 million meals across the nation. So the announcement by the government, the federal government, to cut that funding, unfortunately, was ill-conceived.
What are some of the areas that are most reliant upon your organisation?
Oh, look, the western suburbs is extremely reliant. Then you've got some of the suburbs out towards Campbelltown and Minto and those general areas where there are people who need some help, and even some of the inner city areas that, you know. So we've got over 600 charities registered with us, and, you know, more than half of those are in Sydney.
The aggregate price of food and beverages, according to the ABS, has risen 0.3% since June 2017. Are staple goods such as fresh vegetables and fruit becoming too expensive for lower-income families in Sydney?
They are an issue. One of the problems with fresh produce is it doesn't travel very well. Be a bit restrictive, so the people who come and shop with us, so all the Sydney charities in the main physically come, grab their order and pick and pack it, and then they get access to the fresh produce. But I mean, things like tomatoes and cherries and lettuce and cucumbers and zucchini, they don't travel.
National figures from the Department of Family and Community Services show that family homelessness rates have continued to remain high in Australia, particularly in metropolitan Sydney. So is infant care products and baby formula in demand by the charities in Sydney that you support?
We don't get a lot of baby formula. And so that's one of the areas that we don't see a lot of. It's one of the things that the charities ask, could we put on? We've made a conscious decision not to.
The effects of the drought have obviously taken a profound toll on regional New South Wales, but housing prices and the cost of living are a primary concern for your metropolitan relief programs. So what are Food Banks New South Wales projections for the coming year?
The year we're in at the moment, and I did some numbers with our staff yesterday, after the first quarter, it's looking like that's going to be higher than 13,000 tonne in the year. So that'll equate to about 25 million meals.
Are those figures sustainable for your organisation?
Yeah, they are. I mean, we run a financially sustainable model. We run it as a business. We're a very efficient logistics business with a not-for-profit heart. And we're a business with soul.
The problems facing food relief in New South Wales are obviously divided between a need for regional involvement, but just as well the prevailing issues in metropolitan Sydney. So besides the funding boost, obviously, are there any more plans for the federal government to actively involve themselves in food relief programs?
I'm confident there's a meeting happening with Minister Fletcher and Food Bank Australia and a couple of the other smaller food charities to work through all of these issues. And the reality, we asked them for $10 million, the federal government. And the big scheme of things, that's not a lot of money.
Do you think overpopulation is becoming an issue, and do you think that it'll have a more profound effect upon your business model as the years go on?
Look, we haven't spent any time worrying about that. The politicians will sort that out. We just want to feed hungry Aussies.
Gerry Anderson, CEO of Food Bank New South Wales and ACT, ending that report.
See your creative potential with NIDA Studio Courses. Running part-time across weekends, Studio Courses are a great way to experience NIDA training without giving up your day job. Acting, directing, writing or musical theatre for ages 15 plus. You'll develop your skills over 6 or 12 months in a format that suits your busy lifestyle. Audition in December or January for a February start. Go to nida.edu.au/studios. NIDA sponsors 2SER 107.3.
I'm Max Tillman and you're listening to Razor's Edge, coming to you live from this place known as Sydney on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Sydney isn't exactly known for its vast amount of farming space, yet you would be surprised to know that hydroponic farms are starting to pop up all over the place. So what exactly are these farms and how on earth are they surviving in Sydney? Aliana Brooks has this report.
When you do your grocery shopping, do you ever wonder where your fruit and veggies come from? Maybe you assume they're from a farm far, far away. But have you ever wondered if it's actually possible to farm in Sydney? The answer may surprise you. In Australia's largest city, farming certainly isn't the first thing that comes to mind. Yet scattered throughout Sydney, there are hydroponic farms, growing so much of the produce that we consume daily. That said, most people have never heard of hydroponics.
Have you ever heard of hydroponic farming?
No.
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 Hydro what? No, I haven't.
No. No, I haven't.
Dr. Kim Yan Fantian is a horticultural lecturer and researcher at the University of Sydney. She explains the farming process.
It's a production system that is outside of the soil, and there's a couple of different ways this is done. There's something called a nutrient film technique, so the plant roots are kind of dangling in a thin layer of water or nutrient solution. But there are other systems where media is used, it's just not soil. So it might be something, for example, like a rock wool or some other media that gives the plant something to anchor itself in, but it's not a soil.
Shana Colthart is the head of marketing for Hydro Produce, a hydroponic farm based in Silverwater in Sydney's west.
Hydroponics adds such great value, I think to the whole offer of what customers get. I think there's so much value in the environmental positives around it. It uses 10% of the water that it would take to grow the same crop in soil. It takes probably 10 times the land size to grow again the same volume. So for some things, especially things like your nice fancy lettuce varieties or your herbs, kale is another thing that we grow hydroponically. It ticks all the boxes. I think if you can get something to grow hydroponically, it's just beneficial for the customer, it's beneficial for the environment. And the produce that you get, it's clean, it's sweet, it's soft, it's not affected by those elements that you are at risk from every day and you take a gamble with, which is Mother Nature on the outsides.
Sydney represents a great opportunity to hydroponic farmers. Small land spaces work very favourably when it comes to vegetables and fruit that are densely grown this way. Also, 80% of Sydney's water comes from Warragamba Dam, meaning, for the moment at least, water is in full supply. However, land prices are a massive issue, understandably, in one of the most expensive cities in the world.
It's a hard one because land in Sydney is scarce, and if growers can't get prices that are sustainable long term, and you've got a developer knocking on your door and wanting to pay you a substantial amount of money, and you don't have the next generation coming through to take over your farm, yeah, a lot of people sell up. I can't see farming in Sydney growing, but I hope that it sustains its level because I think it's really nice and quite unique for a city to have a farming basin, a farming body. And hydroponics is brilliant for Sydney and Sydney basin growers because of the space restrictions. So you can have a hydroponic setup on a small acreage or a small area. And I think that that's where there's opportunity for a unique kind of local offer to continue to grow.
Robert Dennis Darcy has a 2.5-hectare hydroponic lettuce farm in Glenorie. He too has felt the hardships of operating a Sydney farm.
It's very hard. Our costs have gone up and our profits are getting squeezed more and more and more each day. So we're looking at new ways. We're ready to turn our whole farm into solar in the next couple of weeks just to save money on our power bill. Our power bill used to be like $4,000 a quarter. Now our power bill is $9,500 a month.
What Kim, Shana and Robert all agree poses the biggest threat and is causing the most damage to hydroponic farmers is convenience shopping.
What kind of prepackaged fruit and vegetables do you buy?
Broccoli, berries, and a lot of baby spinach and lettuce kind of thing.
Carrot sticks and sometimes lettuce.
What prepackaged vegetables do you buy?
I buy prepackaged spinach and probably green beans.
Lettuce and some frozen vegetables.
Lettuce, sweet potatoes and peas.
People's shopping habits have changed dramatically. In the last 10 years, a lot of people shop for convenience. People don't buy a whole cauliflower or a whole cabbage anymore. They buy the pre-mixed stuff that where they open up the bag and it's made by some processor. We're losing a lot of business to these people.
Shana echoes those concerns.
You basically are seeing zero growth in our category in terms of whole head lettuce. And when you look at a pre-packed offer, it's growing 10% year on year. And that's a fact that's come out of, you know, Nielsen. And that's something that's, you know, it's very evident that there's a very big pull towards that. So, yeah, so I guess it's for us, we've got a bit of a journey to do to, you know, reignite some interest around what we do and the benefits of it.
One thing that could affect the hydroponic market and help our local farmers is being granted organic certification. The main argument against hydroponics seems to be because it's grown without soil and in a glasshouse, it's unnatural. However, the controlled and protected glasshouse environment means that very few chemicals are used, pests can be managed with very little interference, and whilst Mother Nature still governs crop growth, she doesn't bring harm. What's more, when you buy a hydroponic lettuce, the root ball is still attached, meaning it's actually a living vegetable.
What does boom is health foods like superfoods, like your beetroots and your baby bok choy, and it's publicised to say, oh, these are superfoods. Those farmers do very well because everyone goes to the store and buys that.
Whilst 100% of New South Wales has been in drought, Sydney's hydroponic crops are not only booming but are in oversupply.
I mean, there's been no rain, so growing conditions at the moment have been very, very good. So with conditions being so very good, everyone's got stock, everyone's got supply, and we've actually got oversupply in the market.
Drought makes everybody, I guess, reevaluate how they do things, and that's what natural disasters do. You know, how can we prevent this from happening? What's our risk management strategy going forward? Water's a really hard one, obviously, and, you know, it's heartbreaking to see that there's a lot of people out there really struggling when it comes to ensuring that their farms have water. But definitely hydroponics, as I said, it uses recycled water systems, and that's part of the benefit, a huge part of the benefit. If only we could do all farming that way.
So, somewhat surprisingly, farming is not only possible in Sydney, but it's successful. Next time you're grocery shopping, take a moment to ask where your fruit and veggies came from. They might be from a fellow Sydney-sider.
Aliana Brooks ending that report. Are you one of those people that carries your smartphone everywhere you go? Smartphones are constantly tracking data about people and their behaviour. Put all this data together and you get a digitised picture of your health and well-being called a digital phenotype. Evie Maguire asked Sally Inglis, an associate professor at IMPACT at the Faculty of Health at the University of Technology, Sydney, about what a digital phenotype really is and what this means for the future of the health industry.
So the digital phenotype is actually looking at, I guess, everyone's like digital footprint to some extent, that it kind of indicates what might be going on with that patient's health. And, you know, in the era now of all these smart devices, you know, we're passively collecting so much digital information that we don't even know about it. In fact, most people probably don't even realise what their smartphone is actually recording about them. So there really is this opportunity to maybe tap into that as a resource, obviously with some caveats around security and privacy and consent. But to really look at, you know, maybe that's a good way that we could use data that's already been collected and with people's consent, use that to help flag perhaps when they do need that little bit of additional healthcare or assessment.
What is telemonitoring, and then how does it relate to a digital diagnosis?
Mm-hmm. So telemonitoring is really the electronic transfer of physiological information. So those are things like heart rate, blood pressure, patient's weight. It can also be, you know, some information around signs and symptoms. And if we talk about heart failure patients, which is my area of research, looking at the evidence to support telemonitoring for people with heart failure, one of the vital things that we really want people to be aware of is changes in their weight, signs such as breathlessness, because these can indicate that the patient's condition is deteriorating. And that can happen over a slower period of time, or it can happen quite rapidly. So telemonitoring is a way of remotely communicating that information between the patient and the clinician.
And what can we do about the data that's already being collected on these devices?
I think that how it compares to the data we're currently collecting is that it just offers perhaps a little bit ease of use in terms of the data might be collected more passively. So rather than the patient needing to consciously remember and say, oh, that's right, I have to actually plug this information in today at 9 o'clock and I have to do it every single day. You know, if these things are set up with obviously the patient's consent, but to be more passive in their data collection, you know, it's less obtrusive in that patient's life. We don't potentially, it might minimise issues to do with, you know, needing reminders or adhering to, you know, protocols of when the patient's supposed to do this. And also, you know, it has maybe a little bit of a security check in there, in the sense that if this data is being collected and, you know, for whatever reason it's not collected, then maybe that also acts as a red flag. Whereas nowadays, you know, adherence can be a bit of an issue. We all forget to do something. Sometimes we get distracted. And, you know, if the patient's not clocking in at a particular time, you know, is that just because they've got caught up, or does that mean something else has gone on? Whereas if it's being collected passively, maybe that's an easier way to kind of monitor things with less burden on the patient's life.
In the article, it mentions an alert system. So say there's someone who's got influenza. How would then the doctor know early on about the symptoms?
I think in terms of the digital phenotyping data, I guess it comes down to capturing things that might flag that the patient's not feeling their normal selves. So, you know, when you take that definition in the wider context, you know, things like that people might put into searches online, you know, whether it's capturing, you know, disturbed sleep, you know, those sorts of things that indicate maybe there's, you know, the patient's just not, the pattern of what we're seeing is out of the normal.
What does this do to the relationship between a doctor and a patient?
Mm-hmm. I think the thing is that I'm a big believer that, you know, face-to-face interaction is still, you know, such a valuable part of healthcare. So whilst we might have all these different technologies that can help to support patients, it can make their lives easier, we can use, you know, mHealth technology for educating our patients, it's still really, really vital that we have that personal connection. And, you know, as a clinician, you know, you need to see the patient. And sometimes just having that face-to-face interaction tells you so much about what's going on in that patient's life, that maybe why they've had a clinical deterioration, what's going on, what other things are they, you know, dealing with that might be complicating their situation. So I think the important thing is that this is a tool, but it's not, it can't be seen as a replacement for that face-to-face interaction.
Do you think that some way this could also mislead someone into a different kind of diagnosis, and then how would that incorporate with the doctor?
So, I mean, where I see these technologies to be initially set up would be for people who have a confirmed diagnosis. There, I see it as a different scenario. The general public, you know, relaying sort of digital health data without any context of what diagnoses that person may have, whose care they're actually under. So I think I see this as an actual formalised interaction between a patient and a clinician, the healthcare service of, so you have this diagnosis, we'd like to set you up on this program, do, you know, with their consent, obviously. And it be actually a formalised sort of process.
That was Sally Inglis, Associate Professor at IMPACT at the Faculty of Health at the University of Technology, Sydney, ending that report by Evie Maguire. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. And if you like the show, catch us again next week on Thursday nights from 7:30. I'm Max Tillman. Tune in next week.